Up next from the 2008 Skoll World Forum is a panel discussion on hybrid business models. Heads of both nonprofit and for-profit organizations discuss how nonprofits are doing away with their limitations and pursuing hybrid models that draw on the best of both worlds.
On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to host a new presentation from the Skoll World Forum on Social Entrepreneurship.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation from the Skoll World Forum.
And to help us frame our discussion of hybrid profit, nonprofit social enterprises, Dr. Tina Seelig, Executive Director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program, a director also of the Stanford University Entrepreneurship Network. Tina teaches a course at the Stanford School of Engineering, and she's worked in the past for the management consultant Booz Allen Hamilton, and she has a PhD in neuroscience, right, from Stanford Medical School. Tina Seelig. So, Tina, you're welcome to go up there and jump in for a moment.
I am the executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. Now, what is that? The philosophy of STVP is that it is not good enough for scientists and engineers to come out of school with a purely technical training. The idea is they really need to understand not just the depth of some specific field like computer science or mechanical engineering or biology, but they also need to understand the entrepreneurial world that they're going to be working in, not just for themselves so they can make better contributions and move ahead in their careers, but also because this allows them to really be change agents. It gives them the tools that they need in order to take problems and view them as opportunities. In fact, that's actually our definition of entrepreneurship and what it means to be entrepreneurial. In fact, one of the most important things that we think about is we are not just defining teaching entrepreneurship about starting new companies. It's about being entrepreneurial in anything you do. And the way we define being entrepreneurial is being obsessed with problems and turning them into opportunities, about creating value and doing this by leveraging the resources around you. And the wonderful thing is this is exactly the same sort of thing that social entrepreneurs do, except that the problems that they pick are very focused on big social issues. So in advance of this, because I don't spend my day every day thinking about social entrepreneurship, but entrepreneurship in general, I did a lot of homework. I talked to everyone I could get my hands on to ask them about social entrepreneurship and ask them about different models. I spent a lot of time talking to my colleagues at the Center for Social Innovation at the Business School at Stanford. Last week, I was at the National Collegiate Inventors and Innovators Alliance with lots of people who were talking about social entrepreneurship, and I would just sort of sit everybody down and say, okay, help me out with this, because I really wanted to understand. And what I've learned is some really interesting things. Let's just start out. If we flash back 40 years, 1968, put us back in 1968, the people who wanted to make a big difference in the world were the social activists. They were the folks who were picketing in front of the nuclear power plants. They were the ones who were trying to get those who were in power, whether it was the governments or the universities or the big corporations, to embrace their ideas. And then on the other side of the spectrum were the corporations, you know, the sort of the capitalists who were saying, we're measuring all of our success in terms of how much money we make. Okay, does that, you guys buy this? And the cool thing is they've learned from each other. And we've created this really wonderful world in the middle now. And so what we have is a social activist who said, you know what, I don't have to wait for someone else to solve these problems, I can do it. I can use these ideas of commerce and enterprise and entrepreneurship to move my agenda forward and to be personally empowered to make that happen. And also, the wonderful thing is the corporations have said, I don't need to just measure my success in terms of the bottom line. line. I can have a double, triple bottom line. I can bake social missions into my goals as well. And so we've created this wonderful soup in the middle where there's a lot of creativity in terms of coming up with products, process, and business models that allow us to move forward some really important agendas here. So what I wanted to do is outline a few different ideas and models that have evolved. But of course, we've got these incredible panelists who are going to dive deeply into some of them, as well as I'm sure many of the people in the audience will have other ideas. And so I realized there was no way that I was going to be able to create an entire landscape of what happens in hybrid social for-profit, nonprofit models because it's an evolving world, and there's a tremendous amount of room for creativity. So I'm just going to outline four different examples, and then I'm going to tell you a little story about something at Stanford and end with a little quick movie. One of the most interesting models that I think is for-profit companies. Companies that basically say, listen, I need to make a profit, but the major reason that they create a profit and that they structure their businesses as for-profit is because having a profit allows their venture to both be sustainable and scalable. And that's the key to entrepreneurship. It's about being able to scale. And so it's very different than saying, I'm going to get a handout and constantly looking for handouts to keep my organization going. In fact, I would say that at STVP, we're social entrepreneurs because every time I take on a new project, take on a new activity, I need to figure out, how am I going to fund this? Is it going to be funded by my customers? You know, am I running a conference and it's going to be paid for that way? Am I going to get sponsors? What are the different ways that I'm going to fund things? And that's exactly what these folks do. They go, okay, how am I going to have real customers who are going to actually pay for this? And one interesting example, actually from Stanford, we have a course called Design for Extreme Affordability. Some of you might have heard of it. It's gotten quite a lot of attention. And what they do is they design products that are appropriate for customers who obviously don't have a lot of money. One short little example, which I think is really inspirational, is one of the teams identified a problem was that in the developing world, there are often babies that are born that need to be in an incubator. Well, you know how much a big incubator in a hospital costs. I mean, it's thousands of dollars. You need electricity. It's got all these monitors. Things break. It's not appropriate for someplace in a remote region. So what they designed is a little tiny sleeping bag. And the cool thing is, actually the hot thing is, that they found a wax that its melting point is at body temperature. So there's a little insert that comes out. You put it in boiling water. It heats up to body temperature. You put it back in. And for several hours, it keeps the baby at the right temperature. And they realized that's really what people need. They don't need all of these monitors. They just need, you know, 85% of the babies that are born prematurely just need to be kept warm. And they can sell this for just a couple dollars. There's a real market for this. And this is the idea of designing for extreme affordability, where your customers are those who are actually paying. Okay, that's one example. There are also the idea that you might have two customers. You might sell your product to a traditional market where they pay market rates, but the profits you get allow you to subsidize that and also give your profits, your products away or your services away to some customers who can't afford it. So you basically have two segments, two market segments, one that is essentially subsidizing the other. Another model is having essentially two businesses. I learned recently about an organization called One Water, very interesting, many of you might know about it, where they have two businesses. One is they sell bottled water, and all of the profits, 100% of the profits, go into distributing special devices that allow folks in the developing world who don't have clean water a way to filter it. So essentially, they have one business that's a for-profit that is designed as a way to make money so that it subsidizes another completely different product to help those who are in need. And finally, I want to just mention the fact that you can have also a traditional not-for-profit venture that uses entrepreneurial approaches, strategies, mindset. And I think that's really an important thing, is that being entrepreneurial is a mindset. It's about looking again at problems as opportunities. In fact, as you mentioned, I teach a course on creativity and innovation in organizations. That's the entire focus of the course. I start out giving my students small problems, and over the course of the quarter, the problems get bigger and bigger and bigger until the students get very comfortable taking on problems that come to them. You know, by the end, they say, bring it on, you know, give me a big problem, and I'll figure out some way to make it happen. So the idea that not-for-profits and who are also have to find creative ways to become sustainable and scalable can use this mindset to make that happen. So let me just step back and tell you a quick little story about something at Stanford that hopefully will be inspirational to you. Last year, the Kauffman Foundation, I'm sure many of you know the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City, it's a very large, influential entrepreneurship foundation, decided to run National Entrepreneurship Week. And in fact, this next year, it's going to be International Entrepreneurship Week. And they called me up and said, because of my role running the Stanford Entrepreneurship Network, would you be interested in helping to lead the effort on campus? I said, no problem, that'd be great. And so I talked to all my colleagues who were there, and everybody took a day. Everybody, you know, the business school, the med school, the law school, the engineering school, the student groups, everyone was putting on programs. I thought, you know, we can all sit around listening, and we're all really good at learning from each other, but let's give people something to do. Let's give a challenge, something that might have come out of my class. And so came up with the idea of giving every team, and these were all volunteer teams, you know, people had to sort of sign up to do this, one, a challenge for 5 days. And every team was given one pack of Post-its, one pack of 100 3x3 Post-its, and told they had 5 days to create as much value as possible, value measured in whatever way they wanted. I told the Kauffman Foundation about this, and they got very excited. They said, well, can we roll this out nationally? I said, let's not stop there. Let's do it, make it international. So with one email to all my colleagues around the world, we launched this international competition. And the interesting thing, I had no idea what was going to happen. In fact, it was one of these situations where halfway through the week, I thought, this is going to be a disaster. But the students always pull it out and do amazing things. 95% of the projects that were done had to do with social entrepreneurship. There were 90 teams at Stanford. There were 90. There were hundreds of teams around the world. And almost every single one picked some big social problem that they tackled in 5 days. Now, the wonderful thing is that this was all captured because there was a film crew, professional Hollywood film crew, that found out about this, and they decided that they wanted to make this into a movie. So they put film crews in 7 countries and watched the students over the course of the week. And this has resulted in a 45-minute movie, which I will be happy to give you the URL. You can get it for free. It's www.imagineitproject.com. Imagineitproject.com. You just click on download the movie, and you can get it. We did another challenge just last month at Stanford, and instead of Post-its, the challenge was rubber bands. And when I announced that at the launch, the air got sucked out of the room. But I have to tell you, students blew me away. And if you want to look at what students, that actually, that footage, they again captured that around the world. There'll be a new movie coming out in the fall, focused on both the Post-its and the rubber bands. And we're launching another global challenge in November. So I want all of you can get involved with this. It's really fun and easy. If you want to see what people did this last year, if you go to eweek.stanford.edu, so there's no www, just eweek.stanford.edu, and you click on look at the winning submissions, you'll see some amazing things that happened this year. So anyway, I want to thank you so much. I can't wait to hear what the panelists say.
Gina Selig, thank you very much. We'll borrow from that statement and call it social entrepreneurship as an extreme sport as we go forward here. By way of welcoming Priya Haji, and you can start working your way up. I was in southern Mexico about a year ago, Oaxaca, and had the occasion to spend some time with an artisan. He, his grandmother, his wife, weave rugs, and they do it in a natural way. The pigments are all natural. They crush these little bugs that make bright red and so forth. And we had a very earnest conversation about not me bargaining him down, as is the classic response of tourists when you go around the world and meet an artisan, but what would be a fair compensation for the amount of labor that he and his family put into these products. It was very interesting. And then we started talking about, is there any way that I had any skills in connecting him to a much wider market? His market was anybody who came down that lane who might bump into him, he might sell a rug to. Well, May I present Priya, who's figured out a way to connect people like the rug craftsman with a huge market. Priya, tell us about what you do.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Priya. I run a company called World of Good. And I just want to say first, I'm so excited and totally honored and psyched to be here. And for me, the joy in this is to share, obviously, what we've been doing, but also because I started World of Good from within Haas Business School with a group of my friends. And so also whenever I'm at a business school, I just feel really excited because I believe in all the next things that are going to happen and all the next people that are here in the room. And so I'm really excited about that too. And so to share what we're doing, you know, when we launched into this, we have a big goal in mind, which is the belief, as you so eloquently described, and this is an example of a product. This is made by a project in Delhi where it works with women in the slums, and they're actually using recycled trash bags that they're collecting from the trash, melting them into this creative pleather, and then turning it into these beautiful bags and things like that. And those of us that have traveled all around the world have seen that there are literally thousands of these kinds of initiatives funded by the UNDP, by Peace Corps, done by church initiatives, all kinds of projects, and they're creating sustainable economic development for many small communities around the world, overwhelmingly empowering women, allowing women to live at home, to not move into working in large factory and formal sector economies, and also allowing them to increase their wages and earnings so that they can better feed their children, increase the nutrition and education of the next generation. So it's a really important activity. And yet, when you walk around in the U.S. market as the world's largest consumer economy, for better or for worse, we actually literally bought $55 billion in gifts last year, of which really only 200 million were in any way related to ethical, fair trade, or conscious consumption. And that includes food products that are not coffee, tea, chocolate. Those are definitely getting much bigger growth. So when we looked at this problem, we were like, you know what? There has to be a structural, scalable strategy that we can use that can really drive this to the next level, change awareness. And really our goal is to see if we can shift 2.5 to 5% of that $55 billion market to conscious consumption. And that really means $5 billion moving to be bought in very different ways around the world and empowering hundreds, if not millions, of mostly women. And so when we went into that, it was kind of this idea that, okay, that is a huge problem. Can it happen? And I think we can do it. And what we did is we looked at some analogies of different industries. And so I want to share, I know we weren't really supposed to use slides, but resist. So one thing we looked at is really the organics industry, or if you look at what's going on right now in clean technology, and what we saw is there's this pattern that we identified. One is that you have to have growing educated consumer demand, which is consumers that are starting to think about their purchasing power differently. Then the second thing you have is on that side is innovation and really companies and businesses that are putting out new products, new strategies to meet that educated demand. And then you have to have the third magic ingredient, which is transparent, replicable standards. So that what happens is, as the demand grows, more innovators enter, but there's clear standards that ensure that you're actually solving the real social problem behind this. So with the organics industry, they looked at how do you get millions of acres to not be farmed with pesticides. Our goal was how do you move millions of dollars to actually empowering people because products are made ethically and sourced in ways that really help the people where they come from. And so that little triple overlap is what we call inspired competition. It's where companies are entering and the competitive market is actually inspiring us to provide the best product, the best thing that really helps people. And that was the triangle that we want to trigger in our market. So what we've done at World of Good, so really quickly, I'll just say our business model is basically we are approaching this from all three of those triangles. What we've decided is that we would love for World of Good to become the recognized leading consumer brand and breakthrough in much the way that Body Shop did in body care, or we saw Aveda has done, or the way that in the food industry you see brands in the U.S. like Newman's Own, We studied a lot of their strategies and what they've done to create that consumer recognition and consumer demand. So in our model, we have focused on a few different initiatives. One is we do a lot of in-store education. We have a huge marketing and PR program where we actually work to reach consumers and educate them not only about the products themselves, but about the mission, the purpose, all of that. The other thing we've just launched is a new marketplace in partnership with eBay, where we have a huge community educational site where the beta has just launched, and this year we'll reach about 250,000 people just with a community site that's educating people about conscious consumption. Then what we developed is certain innovations to bring the product to market. And so the first thing we did, we started 3 years ago, and we came up with the idea of using something like a Hallmark model. So those of you that are familiar in the United States with Hallmark, if you're the CEO of Walgreens and you're thinking about having cards in your store, you don't want to have a million different cards and you're like, oh, I don't want to manage this. This isn't our core business. We really sell medicine. And so we looked at that and said, wow, that's a great analogy. We have an environment where we want to work with hundreds of small producers. We want to get retailers to carry this stuff, but it's too confusing for them, and they don't really know how to do it. And so what we came up with is a store-in-store program where we drop in a fixture and the signage and all the information, and then we run it as a full-service program for their stores. And we now work with 1,100 retail locations in the United States. We grew with a 50-store test was our launch in the Bay Area, and then we grew to 300 stores, which was all across the Western United States, and then we grew to 1,000, and now this year we'll grow to almost 1,800 by the end of the year. Some of our partners are natural food stores like Whole Foods and things like that, and then we've just been working in campus bookstores, so we work with Barnes & Noble college bookstores, and we just launched a partnership to test with Borders, and now we're moving more and more towards the mainstream retail segment so that eventually you'll move into a mall or someplace like that and see these kinds of products. So what we saw in this model is that we can work, we now work with 150 producer groups in 34 countries, and we've been able to create a really flexed supply chain. You know, I can't see the clock, so just so you know. So can you give me a time warning?
3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay. So what we've done is we've really tried to work on how to flex that supply chain, and we keep the assortment changing in the stores, and through that we're able to work with many communities even though each product is scarce. For the retailer, it creates freshness, newness, and change all the time. Then the other thing that we've just launched is what we saw is that in the retail partnerships, we were able to help lots of communities where they can make higher quantities of product, so something like this bracelet. But there are many communities where a producer group just makes one thing, or there might be a person who is already in the U.S. that's helping a community because they did a Peace Corps project or they did something like that. How do we help those to scale? And so we were lucky enough to form a partnership with eBay, which has different kinds of special custom user experiences, for example, StubHub for tickets or Half.com for books. And we're building a dedicated site, which is worldofgood.com, which is just for small producers and people-positive products from around the world to be sold in one place. We've developed a whole trust system and a whole entire logic behind the product so that when the consumer's shopping, they don't just see the product, they learn about it, they learn about the producer, and the entire thing's integrated into one experience. That's launching in the second half of this year. And then we've also been working on individually designed products, and we've done about 5,000 products over the last 3 years that are all handmade. Sorry. And then the last thing that we've done is really, we believe the other key thing is transparent, replicable standards. And as I talked about, we really feel like if we want this to work, other companies are going to have to enter. We want to see Cost Plus and Target and other bigger internet players as well join this. But when they do, how do we ensure that it's actually ethical, that it actually benefits the communities? How do you make this something that every company can do well? And so with that in mind, we have a nonprofit side where we do just standards work, and we have developed tools like the Fair Wage Guide that uses the web to bring together data from 180 countries and help people to set their standards. I didn't get
drill down just slightly on that notion, because I think people will find it fascinating. How do you determine how much you should pay an artisan for all their hard work?
Yeah. So one of the key challenges, obviously, is that, so take, for example, this bracelet, which comes from a rainforest preservation project in Colombia. If you're the producer and you made it, and if I came to you and it took you 20 minutes to make this bracelet and I offered you a dollar, That is an amazing price for that. It could be great for your livelihood. If it took you 3 days to make this product and I paid you a dollar, that's a terrible price. And that seems so intuitive to all of us in this room, but in reality, in sourcing in the informal sector, which is how actually large corporations in the United States are now moving, there are no regulations. The ILO, the UNDP, these standards have not existed for the informal sector. So when we started World of Good, we knew not only can we build a great business, but we have to build clear, transparent standards. And so the Fair Wage Guide is the first web-based tool that takes 200 countries' economic data, makes it immediately accessible in a point of interaction. So a buyer or a producer can go in, look at a product, either redesign based on the time it took for how much they can get for the price, or you can look at the price and look at how much it compensates in relationship to the time of the producer. And that is now being built into being the basis for some different certification systems from the EFOT, from Flow, and then also we have a whole system called Trustology, which is about organizing other trust systems. So last year we worked with like 15,000 women in 34 countries, and this year we hope that will double. And then I didn't really get to this, so I'll just go, forget it, I won't use this slide. But anyway, the main point is what I wanted to compare and contrast, and I can put these somewhere so you can download them. I wanted to compare and contrast the for-profit side versus the nonprofit side and why we chose what we chose. We're, you know, a for-profit, I would say the most important difference. Our business side, the branding and distribution, all of that is all set up as a for-profit C corporation. I'm actually the CEO of the for-profit side. We have on the standards, certification, and all of the development initiatives we do, that's incorporated as a totally separate nonprofit. And it's a 501c3, and it's funded in a completely different way because those, we believe, are assets that need to be held in the public interest. And as the tool, like the Wage Guide, and those standards get evolved, we're working in partnership with almost 100 organizations around the world to build those standards. And those shouldn't belong to any one company. Those are really charitable activities. And they're things that, in the long term, those technologies should belong to open source industry standards. On the business side, what we realized is we really want to grow a scalable brand that's going to get traction and stimulate that inspired competition. And really, the only way we felt to do that was to drive it from a very traditional capital model. I have a slide that does say our capital, and I'll put this up, like I said. And we used our friends and family money. We went through the business plan competitions, and then we raised very traditional financing, including Draper Fisher Jurvetson, who was actually in that previous video as one of our investors, along with Omidyar, along with several large investors. And we've used that capital and partnered it with patient capital, like Rudolf Steiner Foundation, Shared Interest in Ecologic, who are helping us with all of the essentially microfinances embedded into our model. And so we use those and we partner that capital structure in kind of an unusual way on the business side and believe that by growing a brand, we create the returns that will create the sustainability around the distribution system. Our sales are now, we don't release our sales numbers, which is something that businesses do, which nonprofits never understand. And but we have a team of about 65 people. We work with 1,100 retailers, and our sales will be somewhere between, we're in the range of between 8 million and 20 million this year. So it's a really exciting thing for us in a fairly short time. And then on the nonprofit side, we had very traditional, we took all the profit from our first year before we had any investors and dumped it into getting the nonprofit going. That's how we started it. And then we had really great foundations that came on board with us, including things like Levi Strauss. So those are really retailers that are interested in these standards, as well as we had Omidyar came in as well as a foundation. And then we've also had great donors, individual donors that have helped us on building that standards work and building these tools. And I'm happy to talk more about that or anything else, but really excited to share our model. And I hope there are many other industries where I believe billions of dollars can get shifted into the right purpose if we stimulate those three things to occur. And I hope that at least one more great business model is going to come out of this, and I hope ours works.
Thank you, Priya. You monitor global affairs for long enough, and you realize that underneath almost any global affairs story is the issue, frankly, of water. This is a very compelling theatrical release documentary that's out. It was produced by one of our Now colleagues called A Walk to Beautiful. It's about traumatic childbirth injuries, fistula, women, Ethiopia. It's very, very compelling. But sure enough, how come the prevalence is higher? Well, village women in parts of Ethiopia have to carry these huge jugs on their back at a young age. When you see the video, when you see the film of them walking with these jugs, the jugs tower over them. They're three times taller than the person. Puts pressure on the lower spine, changes the development of the pelvis, contributes to this horrific issue that leads to the ostracization of women in their villages. Water underneath that story. We got to lick this problem. Trelans Adi is working on that. Tell us about your for-profit business.
It's a pleasure, and it's a long story, but I'm going to cut to only a piece of it, and when we get to the question and comment period, we can elaborate a little further. I was one of those people who used to carry the water on my head. Now, at that time, it was actually quite an accomplishment for a young boy to be able to balance a bucket of water on his head without touching it and then walking home. And if you do that, you can walk with grace. I don't do that anymore, but I used to do that. I was born in Ghana, and I've been in the U.S. Longer than I intended. In fact, I've lived in the U.S. longer than I lived in Ghana. But through a lucky corporate career, I kept seeing the same picture over and over, whether it's in Asia or Africa or Latin America, it was the same story about water. In fact, there were other things. And I'm a latecomer to the issue of providing clean water to people. I spent lots of my career in medical technology businesses. When I became aware of water and the problem of water, I was aghast. I think for those of you who've been in medical technology businesses, you would say, well, anything that affects 200,000 people is a cause worthy of doing something about. And when I became aware of water, it was 5 million deaths a year. It was 60 million children every year growing up with stunted growth because of diarrheal diseases. And so you ask yourself the natural question, why isn't it getting solved? And our conclusion was that it wasn't that people didn't want to solve it. In fact, there are lots and lots of people with a goodwill to try to solve it. The problem we discovered was that this is the domain that Stu Hart, one of a friend who has been running a sustainable enterprise initiative then at UNC, now at Cornell, used to think, well, this was the domain of government and NGOs. This was not the domain of anything that anybody with quote-unquote smart money ought to be engaged with, because you were going to lose your money. Well, as Priya said, and everybody knows, when you raise money, the first round is friends, family, and fools. So you have to imagine, I didn't have much family here that has any money, and we didn't have many fools where I live. And in fact, if you take money from fools and you disappoint them, you get killed. So that's the worst place you want to go. So you got to look at your friends and you got to figure out how much money do they have to solve these problems. It's a lighthearted way of saying that we recognize that if we wanted to solve this problem on a scale that really makes a difference, then you were talking about something very different from government or NGOs. And around the early 60s in Ghana, you probably know this better than I do because you were there, they built this huge dam, a hydroelectric dam in Ghana, and they displaced a whole lot of people around this dam. To this day, and I think it's almost 40 years or more than that, those people who were displaced still don't have access to clean water. They're still trying to figure out the problem. The story is repeated many, many times, where government will promise that somebody is going to bring you water because you need to do that to win elections, I guess. But it never comes. In the process, all these people are dying. So we decided to take ourselves out of the debate about policy and just do something. So that's what's behind Water Health International. Fortunately, a brilliant scientist from India, Ashok Gadgil, had developed technology that we believed could really address the problem at a very low cost. And so we raised money from friends and that we would call angel investors, and started this process of building a company to supply water to people who are poor, relatively, because that's where most of the problems are. So as we have moved forward, we have tried to keep a strong focus on what it is that we're trying to achieve. We don't care about the names that people call us, whether we're social entrepreneurs, greedy capitalists, whatever we are. The only focus is to solve a problem where there is no solution. And so as we get engaged in these discussions, people often ask me what I am. And as I've said to some people, it serves me well to know, not to know what I am. I have no answer. I think what's important is to chase the solution, as Priya has said. So to cut to the chase, what Water Health does, and our focus is on what we call underserved areas or unserved areas. And these turn out to be mostly in rural communities. We have technology that can apply to many different areas. And as somebody said, well, why don't you do it in the U.S., make a lot of money, and then you can give some money to people who are poor. And our answer is, I've been around long enough to know that where I start is probably where I'm going to end up. It's very difficult to take yourself off that train. So what we've done is to say, we're going to put ourselves on the cliff. We know it's hard to do. If we don't succeed, we are over the cliff. If we succeed, and we intended to succeed, then we have a way of addressing a major issue that can spill over to other areas. So what you see up there is what we do in villages as a micro utility. And I'll get through all the services that we offer. But what Water Health does is to go into villages, and these are villages that could be 2,000 people, 5,000 people, smaller than that, and build these micro utilities. And as many of you know, the problem with water and children and women mostly is that children cannot go to school because they have to walk long distances to go get water. And so the idea is that if you really wanted to solve the problem, you have to bring the water to them. We also said that what had happened many times before, that there are people with great technology, but they ship the technology or the products to places where there's no business ecosystem. So who was going to take these things, put them in place, maintain them? So what we had to do after a long series of thinking is to come out with what we call the end-to-end model. So Water Health is not just a company that sells a product, but provides a total solution. And I just walked through with you how these micro-utilities are born. We go into a village, we actually find an appropriate source of water. And it could be from a well, it could be from a river, it could be from a lake. And for a standard cost, we would go out to maybe 1 or 2 kilometers and bring the water into the center of a community. We would then build these micro utilities, which are water treatment plants, in the middle of the community, because as many of you know who've traveled in the developing world, going to get water becomes a social activity. That's where a lot of women meet and talk and so on. That has its own implications about what happens when you bring the water into the middle of the community. That some of the women feel that they can't run away from their husbands anymore, so it's not as much fun. But outside of that, it makes it very easy for people to get to the water. We build these plants, which are treatment plants that actually provide potable water, which is WHO grade water. And what we say is that if you will not drink that water, the quality of water we provide, if you will not drink it in Santa Monica, California, we will not provide it to anyone. And the challenge is to do this and make it possible for somebody whose household income is $2 a day to be able to afford access to clean water. So that's the focus. It's a technical challenge, it's a business challenge, and that's what we set out to do. So we build these plants, we hire local people, and by the way, these plants belong to the community. They pay for it, and we facilitate their purchase of the system. So it's a community-owned property. We run it for the community. And why do we do that? Why don't we just turn it over to some self-help group to do it? Because we've seen it before. And we call it, when the cameras are away, what happens? The people that you train with the higher enthusiasm, they migrate, they get a job in a city, or they do something else. And pretty soon, whatever you put in place is going down. So we have tried to tie everybody's self-interest to the success of this facility. We charge a fee to maintain it. We charge a fee to operate it. We hire local people and we train them to run it. So we're generating local employment, we hope. And then the community actually can generate excess revenues out of this asset, which it is theirs to keep. So we have, fortunately, ICICI Bank in India, which is our biggest presence right now, decided that this was fundable as a commercial enterprise. So we pay them commercial interest rates, and we finance the purchase through the receivables from the user fees. And as I said, the user fees in India could be as low as 1 rupee for 12 liters of water, or 2 rupees. I guess 2 rupees used to be, about 4 cents or 5 cents. We don't know what it is now with the dollar, but as somebody mentioned.
That must be controversial among some. Some people see water as a basic human right, and the model presumes that you charge money to very poor people.
Interesting question. We're not going to argue the point about whether or not it is a basic human right. As I said, we're dealing with a single factor. Whether it is not or not, while we're doing the debate, 5 million or 2 million people die each year. So our focus is not to take one position or other. We could say it's a basic human right. We are still left with the question, what are those people going to do for drinking, to have clean water? And so it doesn't change. And what has been interesting is that right now they are paying a lot more money for those who want to have access to clean water. In absolute terms, they are paying a lot more money than the people who live in the cities do. It's incredible that I think some of you have seen the data. 20%, 25%, 30% of their disposable income go to clean water. And if they cannot afford that, then they drink the dirty water. And they know the impact of that. So, again, it's not to take a position about whether poor people should pay for water. They buy food, and we believe if we make the water accessible to them, they will pay for it. So that was one of the concerns that people said, they'll never pay for it. When we put our first systems in India, we were in a small village. We had assumed that less than 20%, 30% of the people would adopt. Within 6 weeks, 80% of the people in that village were coming to the site. So they understand the value. Now, what they will not pay for is something that is only marginally better than the muddy water they're drinking. But if you provide quality that's high enough, they would pay for it. And as I said, the whole idea is to make it so that if they make $2 a day, they can afford it.
Any final thoughts before we
Well, the final thought is that the idea of providing all these services to people, and we build these buildings, and in many of the villages in which we work, these are the most attractive buildings in the village. And we were told they were going to destroy it. This is inappropriate, and you guys don't understand how village life is. We took the position that poor or not, everybody appreciates beauty. And when you put beautiful things among people, they tend to take care of it. That has been our experience so far, and we're very thrilled with what's happening.
Jolens, thank you. A while back, a businessman in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, Minnesota, is reading the newspaper, as we all do. He sees an article we probably all saw, that 20,000 children die of easily preventable diseases every single day. And he was affected by that. But unlike many of us, he kept thinking about that. And one day, unlike virtually all of us, he had a brainstorm while sitting at a McDonald's, according to the story. McDonald's, of all places. The general idea was, how can you apply this idea of franchising? Think what you may of the effect that McDonald's specifically has had on the world, to guarantee quality and uniformity in its products. How could you apply that to a higher social purpose? Now, many of us get great brainstorms, big ideas, but the real challenge is to put them into force. What is the reality of it? And so this businessman, Scott Hillstrom, turned to a genius in Kenya, Lisa Kimbo. Tell us how you applied this principle of franchising to bringing health to people who are underserved by Kenya's healthcare system.
Thank you, David. What I want to do is I want to actually talk about three initiatives, because I think the movement through the learning that I've had in terms of running different businesses is what makes this whole discussion around hybrid models, you know, quite interesting, at least from my perspective. I left a career in banking. I studied finance and left a career in banking about 12 years ago because I saw a business opportunity in running pharmacies in Nairobi, which is where I was working. And so I started out by using the same principles that you've had, you know, took all my money and family, friends' money and set up a business which was a retail pharmacy business. Because of the opportunity to professionalize the delivery of a very basic healthcare, you know, intervention, the selling of drugs. Like any good business person, I was targeting those who could afford to pay for the drugs. And being a business person, I was recruiting trained pharmacists to provide this service. And, you know, the business worked. We started with one retail pharmacy. It eventually grew to our own four retail pharmacies. And then I started running pharmacies for the largest HMO. And, you know, with time, I was running something like 11 pharmacies and had a staff complement of over 35 pharmacists and pharmaceutical technologists. And we were aiming to serve those Kenyans who could afford to pay for the services that we're giving. Now, I also found that there was very little automation within the delivery of services. So corporates could not keep track of the payments that were being made out of pocket by employees who had medical cover. And so I went out and I found in South Africa, they had lots of software available for dispensing packages. And I came in and I was using that within our pharmacies and we were some of the first ones to do that. And I found that the use of technology, again, really resulted in a lot of interest from corporate clients. And we built up a large group of corporate clientele. But then the economy took a downturn, and the number of people that we were serving before who had been employed would come into our pharmacies now, and they were out of employment and needed to pay for the products out of pocket and couldn't afford to pay for the product. And so you find, you know, people coming in, and they have this prescription, they're unwell, the doctor has written three, you know, medicines that they need to buy. There I was really promoting this branded products, you know, because they gave us the highest return, and people couldn't afford it. And they would say, well, out of these three products, which is the one product that I need to take that will make me feel better? And out of that one product, you know, can I pay it in installments almost? You know, it was really a very sad situation. And I sat there and I was thinking, why am I running this business where the majority of my clients can no longer afford to pay for the product that I'm selling? It just didn't make any sense. And it is while I was looking for alternatives to good quality generics, to, you know, companies that we could work with and start to exploit that particular opportunity that was coming up, that I met with, you know, the American philanthropist, whose idea was franchising in rural areas and providing not just, you know, essential drugs, but basically a treatment package for people in the rural areas. And so I jumped onto that. I was like, this is great. And eventually I was seeing that that was a model that we could bring even into the cities, because even in the city, like in Nairobi, so many people needed that kind of intervention. So my second initiative then was franchised outlets, working with nurses in rural areas. Rural areas have a whole different kind of different challenges, as you can imagine. In the rural areas, you have problems of geographical distance. People just live very far away from any sort of public, you know, health center. So you have to overcome the issue of distance, the people traveling long distances. But then the other problem in rural areas is the relatively lower population density. So how do you set up a successful business in a village, like, you know, what Trialance is doing with the water? How do you set up a successful business where people are in these remote villages, where the income is low and, you know, they need the healthcare? And that's what CFW Shops is all about. And CFW Shops uses a franchise model to standardize the delivery of healthcare, to keep to a short list of drugs and interventions, to make it efficient so that nurses can deliver care within the rural areas. Now, I've done that for 7 years. And
by the way, the nurses run the franchises for profit.
Yes. The nurses running a for-profit business, so we don't pay the nurses pay themselves out of their business. But there's a centralized franchise organization which is based in Nairobi that provides all the technical assistance, and they have to sign agreements and stick to the franchise principles. And franchising works in this way because of the controls and the standards and building efficiencies by scale and purchasing in bulk. So all drugs are purchased centrally. And I did that for 7 years, have been doing that. And my concern is that I think the lessons that I've really learned over this period is that, yes, the healthcare is really needed. Nurses in Kenya, at least, are available and will work out in the rural areas where they come from. And the nurses can set up at the individual unit level, they can set up a business that is profitable, yeah, for the most part. However, the organization that is required to support this, a franchise organization, really is not going to be in a position to break even and become sustainable for quite a while to come. Because the challenges of supervision, the challenges of delivery of products out there to this rural population just means that, you know, the bigger you're growing, the more money you need to, you know, to continue to invest into this unit. And each unit is not contributing back to the main organization sufficiently to build up a fully sustainable entity. At the same time, when working from Nairobi, you look at the low and middle income areas, and I find there that you have high population densities, you've got people who are in informal employment, but they have some employment, who need healthcare, who are willing to pay for the healthcare, but are, again, getting very shoddy services. So come to Nairobi, go to any of these sort of middle to low income suburbs, and you will find a number of clinics, a number of pharmacies. The quality of the care is not assured at all. You don't know when you walk into any of these outlets whether you're actually seeing a doctor or a nurse or a quack. You don't know when you're buying that medication whether it is a genuine product, whether it is a counterfeit product, whether it's powder. And people who wake up every day to go out and earn a living, a taxi driver, for example, a construction worker, they need to, the same way as we found in the rural areas, they need to be able to go somewhere if they're unwell, see somebody that they can trust, get a service that is prompt, that is efficient, no waiting time, so they can go back and earn a living. Because if that person doesn't earn a living that day, then the following day they're out of a job. And once you're out of a job, now you're into this segment that can, you know, only get charitable donations to survive. So what now I'm embarking on with an organization called LiveWell Kenya is setting up treatment services, full-fledged clinics that will be company-owned, so it's a chain of clinics, that are located within these particular middle and low-income areas, that provide a completely full service, and also are having nurse practitioners providing the services, but with automation and with standardization as really the backdrop of providing efficiency, so that people can get what it is that they want. No waiting time. They have all their records, you know, available. We want to use cell phone technology to be able to track our clients and to be able to send information to clients. And in Kenya, one exciting product that has come up is called M-Pesa, which is a system of paying, you know, payment through your cell phone. So people who do not have credit cards can have an M-Pesa account and they can come in and they can pay for their healthcare using, you know, their cell phone. And then, you know, through automation, you can have a doctor in one clinic, that's the anchor clinic, and that doctor can actually oversee treatments that are being given out in satellite clinics by nurses. And therefore, build in efficiencies in this way so that you do have the medical providers that are needed, but the nurses are the ones that are still delivering care, because that's how you get serious control over the costs and the delivery. So the question, I think, for us is, this is for profit now. Okay, without a doubt, we're in the for-profit, back to the for-profit reign. Within the franchise, we were combining the two. We're sort of saying the nurses are for-profit, but the organization is non-profit. But my experience was just that the entire entity became non-profit. You know, when you have a board that is non-profit, when you have staff that are thinking non-profit, when they engage with the nurses that are for-profit, the entire conversation comes down to who cannot, you know, we cannot afford to pay for this. Are we reaching everybody? It all becomes a very charitable mentality. And that's one thing that I feel that for where we are in Africa today, I think we do need to build sustainable businesses. And I think we do need to be thinking for profit and bring in all of the disciplines of for profit to serve the markets that, that need to be served. Thank you.
Lisa, thank you. The International Convention of the Rights of the Child prevents abuses to children around the world, yet if you visited urban areas around the world, you've seen the conditions of children disconnected from their families, and something has to be done about it. And there have been charitable approaches to this, nonprofit approaches. I want to introduce again Sebastian Marot, Friends International. You could do it as straight NGO, nonprofit, but you're doing really more than that. Tell us about it.
Yeah, thank you. Difficult job coming last. a little about me, because it would probably put in frame what I'm doing and how. I'm not a social worker. I studied political sciences. I work for a French consulate in Japan. I work for L'Oréal, the cosmetic company, in marketing, and ended up working with children in Cambodia initially by accident when I traveled through. So I'm coming from a very different perspective, which probably explains why I'm looking at things a little differently. Friends International, I started Friends International in 1994 in Cambodia. We're working with marginalized urban children and youth, mainly street children, but also migrant children, children from drug abuse gangs, as well as sex workers, and so a large group of children. Our aim is to reintegrate them into society, so really make them, empower them to become functional, productive citizens. And that's really the objective. So immediately we're moving away from a charity base to looking at how we can develop the country, because children, you need to invest in children if you're serious about developing a country. And if you leave all these kids behind, well, you have a load of problems, including the fact that, well, the country goes backwards. You have a bunch of young people that are angry and create problems in violence, international violence, even if you're not careful, and terrorism is a... So you need to really address that issue, and that's why we moved into that. We have five projects, and that's what's important. We start our own projects for street children and other vulnerable children. We try to provide the best services possible. So we collect these all into the Friends Alliance projects, and currently we have projects in Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, Indonesia, and we're opening this year in Hong Kong and probably Egypt. So we're expanding with a range of projects, from outreach, drop-in centers, residential centers, vocational training, remedial schooling, reintegration, and addressing all the issues kids might face, and drugs, HIV, and so on. So this is our social side, if you want. We also realize that if we do this, even if we do the best job possible, if we do it alone, it won't work. So it's only if you work with others that you actually have a bigger impact. So we created what is called the City Network, where we work with a range of partners, work together, build them up so that they provide also best services possible. That allowed us to reach out to contact about 1 million children last year. It's all very nice, but what happens is that NGOs do the work and you disempower societies. I receive phone calls from people saying, oh, I've found this kid, what are you doing, NGO? My answer is, what are you doing, you? Community person, what is, you know, you're responsible for your own children. NGOs are taking away responsibility. So the game here is to give back responsibility, and we created the Child Safe Network, a huge network where we train key people in communities to protect children, and the community is taking back power. And then we also say, well, children have to be very much involved in finding solutions to their own problems. So we started another project again called Urban Action, where young people are supported to start projects for their communities, for their own friends. Now, all this is all very nice. It costs about $3 million a year. And a few problems. First problem is I'm going to see these kids, I'm going to see these families, and I say, you're empowered, you can do it, you can make the money. And then as an organization, I have to do the same. I have to do what I preach. I cannot go and see donors all the time, say, please give me a little money so I can run my project. So I want to do what I'm telling them, as an example. The other thing is also, we're working in countries where donations, international donations, going down. Cambodia is off the list, more or less. I mean, there's still a lot of attention, but it's going down. Other countries are more, have much more attention now. Laos, no donor knows where Laos is. It's very difficult to find money. Thailand, everyone goes to Thailand and says, oh my God, look at Bangkok, beautiful, they don't need anything. Indonesia, oh my God, they got billions of dollars with tsunami, they don't need anything. So getting money in those countries is getting more and more and more difficult. So yet again, another reason why we need to find our own funds. So this is why we started what I call the Good Money Enterprises, which the objective is to support all our activities, generate funds so we can support all our activities and not rely on donations forever and ever. And we do this in three main directions. We have what we call the vocational training businesses. Now, I told you that we run vocational training for young people. It's a big, major part of what we do because we talk about empowering, making them citizens, and making them sustainable citizens. Vocational training is key. Traditional vocational training is you put kids in a center, they all study, and then you dump them in the real world, and they're really not ready for the real life because your vocational training and real life are somehow too different. They're not really ready because they didn't have the real experience. And from very early on, I decided that all of vocational training should be run like businesses. Benefit one, young people. Because, of course, we don't do child labor. So young people, very important. Young people get this hands-on experience, real life. And if you're good enough, you generate profit and your training is sustainable and you don't rely on donors. So we have started basically all our vocational training. And in Phnom Penh, for example, we have 12 different trainings. They're all geared towards business. The most prominent are probably our restaurants. We have three restaurants in Phnom Penh that are run as trainings, and they work absolutely fantastically well. Great response. The trick here, of course, is people come to your restaurant first because, oh my God, it's a charity, I'm supporting these poor children. What we want is them to come back because the food is good and the atmosphere is great, and it works, and it supports humongous chunk of our activities. Now, we have a lot of other of these training businesses. Then we move towards something else very close to what you're doing, is what we call social businesses, where the problem was, okay, we're helping those young people and we support our vocational training. What about a school where younger children go and they don't work and they shouldn't work? So we turn towards the parents and mostly the mothers and start social businesses. Now, social businesses are, for us, money-making ventures, but the first objective is, of course, a social profit and not so much a financial profit. The social profit being that parents are, income is increased and they're able then to support their own children and the positive cycle has kicked in. If on top of that there's money made and we can support ourselves and so on, then it's excellent, and we are working very hard to achieve both. That works also very nicely. We have over 100 families now that are producing different things and making on average over $100, $120. That's in Cambodia. It doesn't sound like a lot, but a teacher is making $25, $35 a month. So the families are doing quite nicely. So social businesses is a very, very interesting part of what we're doing. And there's a lot of, I mean, probably in the discussion, we'll have more time to go into details. However, we also have then the last one is the really profit-making initiatives where we have goods that we create and we sell. And we have cookbooks, we have T-shirts, we have a lot of ranges of different articles that we sell. Cookbooks, for example, we made over $160,000 just with one cookbook. That's a great income generation for the organization. So all this allows us to be, our main project in Phnom Penh is 35% sustainable now, which is a great achievement when you think of working with children in Phnom Penh, from Phnom Penh. We're not in the US with a huge market. We're with this tiny little country, tiny market. That's a big challenge for us. So the results are very, very positive, and I would, and we encourage all our partners to move towards that, and it's part of what we do when we work with our other NGOs is to build them up so that they can generate their own profit and money. Thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Skoll World Forum. This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Mike Seifried. Our website editor was Peter Christensen. The series producer is Niels Makel.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nie on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.